You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Voltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, zucchini bread is a popular treat this time of year, but does anyone actually like zucchini? We talk with a skeptical food reporter about his quest to find out if zucchini can be good all on its own. First, many K-12 students around Wisconsin had their first day of school this week, and the UW system starts classes today. Whether those classes are in person, virtual, or a mix of both, school during a pandemic is different, and it can feel strange for students and parents. We want to hear from you. How are you feeling about this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. The lines are open now. What's on your mind as school starts up again? Are you worried about the spread of the coronavirus and whether schools are able to get going safely? You can call 800-642-1234. Are you happy for your kids to get back to something that feels normal again? Or does it just seem like a lot of work? Maybe you're feeling kind of uncertain about things. And if you're a student, also a line for you. We'd love to hear your experience at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A new report looked into how students were feeling as they got ready to go back to school. More than 40 students from 13 schools in Marathon County participated in focus groups so they could talk about safety and learning and extracurriculars. Sharon Belton is the director of the University of Wisconsin's Institute for Public Policy and Service Research Partners. She helped author this report. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You talked with students from districts that are trying a variety of approaches, starting the year all online, some going in person, some mixing the two. What kind of things did you ask kids about in these focus groups?
Well, what we really wanted to do with the focus groups was to dig deeper into what were the concerns that students were feeling with respect to resuming classes in the fall, regardless of what format their school was going to be using. And so we talked with them about a range of things, starting with their experiences in the spring with learning at home, what worked well and what didn't, sort of as a way to get them talking more about what they were anticipating for the fall, not just with respect to safety and, you know, COVID-related concerns, but things related to their learning, how they would learn, how they would stay connected with their teachers and their peers, their social environments, and their communication and engagement with their schools.
For all of these students, the year is going to be different in some way. What are the common emotions kids are pointing to as they readied for back to school?
Well, one of the most compelling themes that we heard across all of the focus groups that we did, both at the middle school and the high school ages, is that students were feeling a lot of anxiety and stress about returning to school, driven partially by the uncertainty that they were experiencing with respect to what their learning environments were going to be like. While they obviously were very concerned about safety-related aspects of returning to school, those safety concerns were really secondary to what their learning environment would be like. Many of the students, particularly at the middle school ages, expressed a certain level of fear about the sudden and unpredictable changes that might occur in learning environments this fall, both with respect to starting in person and having to potentially shift to being at home, as well as those starting virtually, the circumstances and criteria under which they would have to then go back into an in-person environment. So really what we heard from all of the students across the board was that they wanted some specifics and details about school this fall that would alleviate some of their stress. What would their schedules would be like? What would their daily routines be like? How would they get questions answered directly from teachers if they had them? How would they be able to learn with their fellow students, which they all found particularly engaging in terms of being in a school environment, how they were going to connect with their friends, and in particular, what would school safety plans be with respect to being on site.
And we're talking about this on the Ideas Network, taking calls at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent or a student going back to school, want to know how you're handling it, whether you're worried about some things or you feel pretty comfortable given what your district has talked with you about, you can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Sharon, We've seen school districts having to make plans and lots of input from parents. And it's kind of striking that we haven't necessarily heard a lot from the students who are affected primarily by all of these decisions.
Right. That's exactly what motivated us to do this project. I mean, for months we've heard public policy discussions taking place about should schools be open on site? Should they be open virtually? What kind of safety protocols should be in place? And we had noticed that in none of the policy discussions that we had seen was there really substantive information being reported on the perspectives of students. And so our motivation for this project was to help fill that information gap, at least for this area of Wisconsin, with the thought being that many of the lessons that we learned for this project could have implications, you know, statewide for districts across the state struggling with the same issues.
Yeah, because they're all dealing with it in different ways, for sure. With school underway now, what do you hope people, not just in Marathon County where you did the survey, but also around the state, what do you hope they keep in mind as this strange year takes shape?
I guess one thing that really came through from the students we talked to is that they have a very high level of understanding of COVID-19 and what the implications are with respect to, you know, spread of the virus and safety implications. And they want to be engaged in the decision-making process with school leaders about things that are going to be impacting them at school. They're hoping to engage with school leaders, not just, you know, on an occasional basis, but an ongoing basis. And we heard from a lot of students that while schools may do an excellent job communicating with parents, that information doesn't always filter down to the students. And that sort of disconnected information sharing was a source of a lot of stress for them. A second thing that I think is important for schools to keep in mind is that many students expressed some positive aspects of virtual learning that they hoped might continue on into the future, as, you know, either virtual learning is considered on a temporary basis this fall or perhaps on a more longer term basis, that students really liked the independence and the flexibility of virtual learning. At the same time, wanted some kind of structure and routine with their learning environments. And so finding that balance between allowing students independence, but also structure and routine, was really important to them as critical to their ongoing success this fall and into the future.
And what should we think about counselors, school support staff, as we're going into this year?
Yeah, I think that's a real critical area of need that we heard from the students. We, you know, heard from many of the kids that their anxiety and stress were piling up, that not being connected with their friends and their peers in the way that they were used to or in the ways that they need was really a top of mind mental health concern for a lot of kids. And they want more access to mental health support, not just, you know, for those crisis situations, but for those ongoing conversations that are so important to making sure kids are doing okay, and providing opportunities for kids to stay connected with each other, even if they can't be physically present on site at school, is very important to them as well.
Sharon, thank you for sharing this with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sharon Belton is the director of the University of Wisconsin's Institute for Public Policy and Service Research Partners. She talked with us about her report on how Marathon County students are feeling about heading back to school. And we talked a lot about K-12 students. And right now we've got Max from Appleton, who's also a student who wants to talk with us. Hi, Max.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your situation?
Well, I'm going to UW Oshkosh, and they haven't reopened just yet. But we did have online classes at the end of the last semester, you know, starting in March, right as this pandemic was really getting going. And when all of your classes or even some of your classes are all online, I find that it's a lot harder. And a lot of people who I went to school with, they all wanted to just go back to in-person stuff. Now, this coming semester, it's going to be about 50-50. Half my classes are going to be in person, half not. But, you know, for all these classes, especially my major that are going to be online, I feel like I'm not getting, you know, my money's worth. And I'm happy the school is taking precautions, but we're taking precautions. But still, a lot of these classes are ending up online. And, you know, it's just not worth the tuition almost. Mm-hmm. And a lot of teachers are leaving. My major, which is radio, TV, film, got like gutted. We lost a lot of teachers. And then my minor, which is history, also lost a lot. So now, you know, I'm left where I'm paying, you know, nearly $10,000 in tuition, and what am I getting for it?
Yeah. Max, thank you for sharing that with us as we consider the fact that the UW system starts classes today, and that might be in person in some places or virtual or online. And we really appreciate your call at 800-642-1234, Max, helping us understand what that's looking like at the college level for you. And we also want to welcome Emily from Madison, who has a perspective here. Hi, Emily.
Hi, I am a parent in Madison. I have two children who should be going into kindergarten, one who should be going into first grade. The city is offering daycare to compensate working parents that is being held in the elementary schools, which you can pay $215 a week for per child, which basically reads as you can pay for in-person learning, but, you know, again, only if you can afford it. And so I'm, as a working single parent, I'm looking at being out $3,000 a month in order to put my kids in care so I can work. And virtual learning does not come anywhere close to replicating what they're going to be getting in person.
So Emily,
I mean, we're looking at an hour and a half max of video for kids who can't read and are supposed to sit in front of a computer for 6 hours.
So you'd rather have your kids in person this fall?
There is, according to CDC, current death rate says that it's less than 0.1% of all fatalities so far from COVID are kids 0 to 17. The risk is not there for the kids, and the risks for not being there are huge.
I appreciate that, Emily, and that perspective. And certainly one of the concerns is not just with death rate in children, but also the fact that children seem to be good vectors for spreading things, even if they thankfully don't experience it quite as heavily. And let's go ahead and take one more call on this subject, because we've got Anne from Fredonia on the line who wants to share with us. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yes, so I went back to school on the 1st. And I have just been seeing a lot of different kind of divides between students, and some are trying to, you know, kind of, you know, rebel against the rules and the precautions that have been put in place. But generally, I think things are going pretty smoothly thus far. And our school has done a really great job of rescheduling just how the day is going to flow. And there's a lot more precautions put in place than I had expected. And so far, things feel really safe, and I think it's going pretty well, and that things should stay running smoothly, and that we should be staying open and in person for the foreseeable future.
So you're seeing precautions and fellow students taking them. Oh, what year are you?
I'm a senior this year.
In high school. So you're seeing your fellow high school students take this seriously? Very good. And thank you so much for sharing what it's like as a high school student right now in a pandemic. Best of luck to you for sure. We have been talking about the first day of school and how it's so much different here during a pandemic. And we really appreciate your calls as we have figured out what the school year is looking like and how we feel about it here in Wisconsin. You can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And just ahead, a Wisconsin food reporter challenged his readers to change his mind on zucchini, something he says might be best in bread and surrounded by chocolate chips, but not worth much elsewhere. We'll find out if they've swayed his opinion. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, we've got the week in Washington when we are talking about all eyes being on Kenosha, Wisconsin, especially when it comes to the presidential race. So we'll get an update from a reporter on the week in Washington. First, we've got a zucchini skeptic on the line. He made a bold claim at the end of July that zucchini is really only good in some bread with some chocolate chips. He made some room for those dishes where it's accompanied by cheese or sauces, but on its own, not so much. And then he challenged his readers to give him tips or recipes to prove him wrong. So if you're passionate about zucchini one way or another, we'd like to hear from you now. The line's available at 800-642-1234. How do you make zucchini great? What's the secret? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Daniel Higgins is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Northeast Wisconsin. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Dan, what do you want to say about your attitude toward zucchini prior to their readers' recipes and tips?
Before this, I kind of came to a breaking point where I had roasted some zucchini in the oven, and it came out, and it's like this mushy, you know, bland stuff. And I roasted it the way I roast other, you know, like cauliflower or other vegetables that, you know, come out, and they come out great. A little olive oil, a little salt, and that's all you really need, and you get this.
Oh, Dan, we might have lost you just now. We'll try to reconnect in just a moment. But we are taking your calls if you love zucchini or you don't very much. 800-642-1234. Maybe you will eat that vegetable when you put it in bread or muffins or hide it in something else. Perhaps you do know a way to make zucchini taste great and show its own flavor all on its own. Tell us your secret at 800-642-1234 as we figure out whether zucchini on its own is worth the effort. Certainly now is the time of year where we're seeing lots of zucchini coming out of the garden, different sizes. Maybe you are tackling a giant zucchini and you're trying to figure out what to do with it because you missed it right under one of the leaves. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Help us understand how you use zucchini. Maybe you do use it in bread or you choose to make other things. I know Dan Higgins, we're working to reconnect with him, but he also found some really incredible things. He offers us some zucchini wisdom that he discovered. He says, go small, peel it to get rid of the bitterness, use dip because dill and ranch dip, of course, make the list because it's a powerful cure-all for improving icky flavors, Dan writes. And he also suggests we boil it, fry it, or I think he's using casserole as a verb here, to casserole it. Lots of casserole recipes when it comes to zucchini. So that is certainly another option when you are dealing with your garden variety zucchini. Tell us how you use it again at 800-642-1234. Whether you love zucchini or not, we'll take those calls from you. Also, I just want to highlight something that really was a zucchini fail for Dan. He tried to grill it, and it did not work out for him. Although, putting it in something like a quiche really worked when we combined zucchini with all of the rest of the things. And I want to go back to Dan Higgins now because I really want to understand, Dan, how the zucchini quiche maybe changed your mind about zucchini here.
It worked well. I mean, part of it was parboiling it, which I'd never really thought of doing ahead of time. I think there's just something that helped with that, but I just think, you know, once it gets into like a casserole or something like that where you want some of that moisture, that's where it really starts to take off. And especially when it's not, doesn't necessarily have to be the main focus of the flavor. It seems like it's more of a, as one reader wrote to me, you know, it's more of a supporting actor type vegetable, or actually technically a fruit, but so I think that's what, once I hit that, and then the salsa was kind of the same way.
Zucchini salsa.
Yeah. And that again, you know, there's something that's, you know, it's liquidy, so you're not trying to get something crispy or something, you know, dried or fried or whatever. So it really kind of just played right into where it would be. And in the light flavors, you know, this also, you want kind of a balance of flavors. I think that's part of the appeal, and it's that kind of a piece of produce that it really just works well in those situations.
And what kind of advice in general did you find from people?
It was, you know, a lot of people. The most common thing was, you know, the smaller the better, generally speaking. 5 to 8 inch, you know, pick them out that are, you know, maybe in that 5 to 8 inch range, you know, maybe 3 inches wide, you know, so the smaller is better, you know, making sure to scoop out the seeds, don't, you know, when you're using it as well. You know, but there are people that just really have a taste for it. You know, people are like, they just like to peel it and dip it in ranch or dill dip or whatever, and all that kind of stuff too. But, you know, another common one is to, you know, to peel the zucchini, because it's kind of where some of that bitterness can come in that maybe people don't like as much. And I had, you know, several people come up, give me ideas too, you know, like putting, you know, making zucchini noodles out of it, which I know, like, I think Noodles and Company does that's an option if you don't want pasta. And I've had that before, and it's not bad. Just a wide range of ideas on what to do with it.
Good options there. We've got Nancy in Milwaukee who has a bit of insight. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. That failure trying to grill the zucchini has to do with high water content. But my favorite way, other than eating it raw, is putting it in a smoothie. It is better, certainly, to peel it first and maybe take out the seeds or maybe leave the seeds in. But in a smoothie combined with a banana and berries, it is just wonderful. And it's just such a nutritious vegetable.
Oh, Nancy, yep. Thank you for that suggestion. Dan, did you drop any in a smoothie?
I know, and I was going to, and I just didn't quite get to it, because I actually had one reader sent in that he said he uses it in his protein shakes every morning. He chunks them up in the freezer, and that's what he uses with a little bit of water and his protein shakes in the morning. So, that totally fits. You know, it's a mild flavor, so it's not going to overpower anything. It's very, you know, it has a lot of moisture in it, so that's what you want in a smoothie. So I definitely could see that. Those working very well there if you want to get it in there.
So, Dan, this is a yes or no question. Did readers change your mind about zucchini?
A little bit. They changed my mind in terms of, like, how to use it. It's not like I don't see it as, like, this overall everywhere. I just love it. But I think in the right situations, it's got its place. I just don't know with how prevalent it is how many of those things you can make, because it's just such it's a squash that just kind of just can take over a garden and just multiplies at a crazy
rate. Definitely. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, Daniel Higgins is the food and drink reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Northeast Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's the week in Washington, a look at some of the top national political stories that come right home to us here in Wisconsin. I'm Keeley Voltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up tonight at 6 o'clock here on the Ideas Network, you can hear 1A+. This year's election battleground is well-worn territory. 1A is making room for those who have just as much to say, those being constantly canvassed in the swing states. Tune in tonight at 6 to hear that conversation. 1A Plus is a new program here on the Ideas Network. It's one of the changes we've made to stay connected to our state and our world. And in addition to a few new shows and other changes, you'll find both 1A and On Point at new times. Tune in. Let us know what you think. You can see the details on our website. Just go to WPR.org/fall2020. It's Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is shaping up to be a focal point in this year's presidential race. Republican incumbent Donald Trump was in Kenosha yesterday. Tomorrow, Democratic challenger Joe Biden will visit the city. It's been rocked by the police shooting of Jacob Blake, subsequent protests, violence, and damage. It's the week in Washington, where we catch up on some of the week's top stories in national politics, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you were in Kenosha yesterday, did you go out to see President Trump during his visit? What motivated you? What did you see? How did it make you feel? Maybe you weren't there for President Trump, and instead you were there to protest police violence. Do you welcome the attention Wisconsin is receiving as the presidential campaign heats up? Call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest is Scott Wong. He's senior staff writer at The Hill covering the House of Representatives leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
We'll get to a lot with Trump and Biden's Kenosha visits and the race going forward. First, though, let's talk about Steve Mnuchin. The Treasury Secretary was on Capitol Hill yesterday testifying about coronavirus economic relief. For weeks, things have been at a standstill as far as negotiations. What should we know about what's happened this week?
Well, he appeared on Capitol Hill before the special House committee that's investigating the federal response to the coronavirus crisis. And he was a Treasury Secretary who appeared very eager to cut a deal, eager to get back to the negotiating table with Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And he said both he and Trump believe that more aid is needed. He talked about common agreement where he agrees with the Democrats on funding for schools, testing, a return to this expanded unemployment insurance, more money for small businesses. But it looks like the big hang up right now is additional aid for states, cities and counties, which have taken a huge hit, as you know, because of falling tax revenue. Mnuchin and Pelosi did speak last night for about 35 minutes, but Pelosi said there was no broad consensus, and so things are still at a standstill. The Senate, however, will be moving forward with what we call a skinny, pared-down stimulus package, about $500 billion. But it looks like Senate Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, may filibuster that, which leaves us back at square one.
Okay, so some movement, but not a whole lot of progress. We've seen the administration with a few moves of its own outside financial relief legislation. One is President Trump's so-called payroll tax holiday that kicked off yesterday. How does that affect the conversations in Washington?
Well, in the absence of a big, broad coronavirus deal on Capitol Hill, the Trump administration is trying to take executive actions to help out Americans who have been negatively impacted by coronavirus. So one of the ideas is this payroll tax, tax holiday, or it's a temporary thing where employers could choose to defer paying payroll taxes. That's money that goes into the Social Security program so that workers or their workers would have more money in 2020. However, they would have to pay a greater or have greater taxes withheld in 2021. So it's really a deferred tax payment program. It seems that few employers are choosing to participate. It's really unclear at this point how many are going to go down this path. A lot of people see it as too risky. And so it's unclear at this point what type of impact this is really having for American workers.
Well, we also heard that there's now going to be a nationwide ban on evictions coming into effect. That's through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC.
Yeah, it's an interesting creative move. The CDC, another sort of executive action from the president through the CDC, is going to make it illegal or has made it illegal now to evict somebody who's been negatively impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. This could cover millions of Americans who, as we know, have been struggling to pay their rent because of lost wages or losing their job. There are certain requirements. You have to make less than $99,000 a year, or as a couple, $198,000 a year in 2020. but this is not rent forgiveness, as we've heard from some liberals calling for rent forgiveness or the cancellation of rent. The rent is still owed to the landlord on the back end. And so eventually this money will all have to be paid back. And so you have housing advocates saying, watch out for that cliff. This really sets up renters for failure when this moratorium ends at the end of the year.
Mm. We're talking with Scott Wong, who's a senior staff writer at The Hill, and we're getting the latest on the week in Washington, which also is the week in Wisconsin, as we've seen so much happening in Kenosha, from the president visiting to also Joe Biden planning a trip tomorrow. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234, wondering what you think about the situation, how you see politicians handling Wisconsin. Do you feel like they're here to help, or do you think they're making the situation worse? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Scott, President Trump visited yesterday, greeted by a mix of supporters and protesters along his motorcade's path when he went from Waukegan's airport to Kenosha. What stood out to you from Trump's meetings or tours of the damaged areas or public statements?
Well, he really wants to hammer home this message that he is supportive of law enforcement, that he is the law and order guy. And, you know, standing in front of the burned out building, he's sending a message to voters in swing states like Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan that, you know, I'm the guy that's going to be here to protect you from these radicals that are setting fire to businesses and causing violence in some cities around the country. But, you know, Joe Biden has been much more aggressive in recent days, speaking in Pittsburgh, and then tomorrow he'll be in your state, in Kenosha, pushing back on that narrative in a much more aggressive way, saying that the president is actually the one fanning the flames of the violence, that he is the reason that we're seeing chaos across the country. And Biden is really pointing to himself as saying, I'm the guy that can bring calm to the situation, not Donald Trump. And so you surely are seeing the battle lines being drawn in this election as we head into this home stretch after the two Democratic and Republican conventions.
We've got Charlie in Milwaukee ready to join our conversation. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. With that in mind, I was wondering if your guest could tell us, since he is a reporter for The Hill, which is probably one of the most neutral and one of the best news sites still on the Internet, I'd like to have him comment on what he sees with the mainstream media for what they are talking about and causing all the violence that's going on. A couple weeks ago on CNN, they had this was a fiery but peaceful protest, and they said they downplayed the violence. Now that that's turning politically favorable for Trump, they're now saying that Trump is the cause of it, which makes me think that the mainstream media can't be truthful about anything. Hmm. They couldn't be truthful about Brennan.
Yeah, let me hop in here, Charlie, because I just want to make sure that our guest has a chance to respond, because Scott, Charlie's saying, how are we supposed to trust everybody trying to cover this? And what I hear in that is that we have a lot of different narratives going here.
Yeah, and that's always going to be the case in a presidential campaign. It's about who controls the narrative, who is getting their message out. And one way that certainly Joe Biden is able to get his message out and to continue to pump out campaign ads is he had an enormous fundraising haul of more than $350 million in the month of August. I think that was a record-setting haul. And so you're going to see Biden just continue to flood the airwaves in your state and in swing states around the country. And, you know, he's out fundraising President Trump. I think you can say that probably points to where some of the enthusiasm is in the country, people more willing to open up their wallets. The other point I would make just about, you know, the bias of the news industry. I mean, the two campaigns today released or the Presidential Debate Commission, which is a bipartisan commission represented by both campaigns, released the moderators of the debates. And so this is the next phase of the campaign is now we're heading into the debate season. There will be three debates. They've agreed on moderators. And so you will see now the two messages going head on with each other, the two candidates going face to face with some pretty well-respected moderators, including C-SPAN's Steve Scully, who I know very well, as well as Kristen Welker from NBC and Chris Wallace from Fox News. And so there is some common agreement between the campaigns and in these moderators, and it'll be interesting to tune into these debates in the coming weeks.
We're talking with Scott Wong from The Hill. It is the week in Washington, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see our political leaders handle what's happening in Kenosha, whether it's on police reform or racial injustice? How do you see them changing the way that they're campaigning for president based on what's happening in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. You're part of the conversation we're having here on Central Time. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill, and we are talking about some of the week's top national political stories, and they come from Wisconsin. Thanks for giving us a call at 800-642-1234. We've got Mo in Oconto, who has a point he wants to make. Hi, Mo.
Hello. My thoughts are this. Who's the president now and what's going on? Kellyanne Conway has stated that this violence and unruliness behavior is benefiting the president, so why would he stop it? And if he's the only one that could stop it, he sure doesn't seem like he's that eager to do that. Thank you.
Mo, thanks for that comment then. And Scott, that's some criticism we're seeing of the president's visit, that people think that he's not necessarily there to try to create peace.
Well, as you probably have reported, there were a number of Democratic leaders in your state who asked the president not to come because they feared that he would fan the flames of a very tense situation in which lives have been lost. And, you know, it's also a message that you've heard from Joe Biden himself, saying that President Trump is encouraging violence or wants to see violence or is cheering on the violence because he believes it will help him in this election. You know, the reason why I think we saw the president go to Wisconsin yesterday and Joe Biden coming tomorrow is because, you know, there are crucial voters in your state, particularly in the suburbs. And that's, you know, one of the groups that both sides are targeting here. Is this fight for suburban, educated, college-educated voters. President Trump knows he needs to make gain ground after losing a lot of those voters in the 2018 election. I think the campaign believes, if you've watched their ads and listened to their rhetoric, they believe that this sort of message of fear and that the radicals are coming, led by Joe Biden, is a message that could drive some of those voters, white college-educated voters, back to the Trump side. But you're hearing Joe Biden, you know, really push back, saying, you know me. He's trying to appeal to those same voters, saying, you know me. Do I look like one of those radicals? And then secondly, he's also denounced the violence yesterday, denounced the looters and the arsons, and saying those people should be prosecuted. Suburban voters are going to be a big part of the narrative in these coming months.
Babette in Milwaukee has something to contribute here as we are talking about this. Hi, Babette.
Hi. I did, even though I've been a protester, peaceful protester, at past things in Kenosha and Milwaukee, I did not go to the Trump anti-Trump protest yesterday because I did not want to be a part of his next election ad, because I think that's what he was there to do. At the same time, I am very opposed to the violence from the protesters when they become rioters and when they burn down buildings and when they beat up one store owner who had his jaw broken and such. That I'm very opposed to, and it's hard to get through to some of those other protesters because I've argued with them. So I'm glad to hear that Biden is coming and that he has in the past condemned the violence. I hope he will do so again, and I think that the violence on the part of the militias also needs to be condemned.
Babette, thank you so much for that call. And Scott, what are you hearing? Because we did hear the president yesterday say, we're going to spend money here. We're going to send money here to help businesses rebuild. Are both political candidates for president using the damage to their advantage also?
I'm not sure about that. I haven't followed exactly how much money in funding will be sent to Kenosha or to Wisconsin. You know, one thing that struck me this week was to see Joe Biden get out in Pittsburgh. Today he was in Delaware, his home state, and tomorrow he's going to be in Kenosha. And that suggests to me that he is listening to some of the criticism in his own party, the hand-wringing from Democrats saying, you can't stay hunkered down in your basement. You got to get out and show people that you're listening to them, that you're in the places where these events are happening, that you have a connection to some of these events that are happening nationwide. And so I think it's significant that, you know, Biden and President Trump is forcing Biden to do that by touring all of these swing states from very early on today. President Trump was in North Carolina. So I think you're going to start to see this campaign, despite the coronavirus crisis, really start to resemble more and more a traditional campaign, not necessarily with the full campaign staffs and the cheering crowds, but the candidates are now out of their bubbles and will be crisscrossing the country in the coming months.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House of Representatives leadership, and we're talking to Scott for this week's Week in Washington recap. Another story we are following is over the weekend, we learned that the Director of National Intelligence, John Ratcliffe, would be halting in-person congressional briefings on matters of election security and interference. What's this about?
Yeah, John Ratcliffe is a staunch ally of President Trump. He was a member of the House of Representatives has been very close to the president during his time in the House. And earlier this year was made Director of National Intelligence, overseeing all of the intelligence community from the White House. And he says he informed Congress this week, there will no longer be in-person election security briefings for lawmakers. He said he's concerned about unauthorized leaks of classified information that Democrats could run to the media with stories that they learn from these briefings. He says there will be written briefings, however, but lawmakers, you know, will be restricted now from being able to ask questions in real time on these important national security measures. And I think it's just another example of the political polarization of now intelligence issues. And it comes at a time, as we know, when Russia and China are looking for ways to impact the presidential election. Democrats don't have much recourse. They're threatening to block off funding for the DNI. But, you know, with the election 60 some odd days away, I think their hands are really tied and not much will be done before the election.
So lawmakers can't ask questions. What do we as the general public lose with not having these in-person briefings?
Well, a lot of these briefings are classified in nature, which means that most of the information is not being shared with the public. But, you know, Congress has an oversight responsibility. And so part of that responsibility is to get information from the executive branch, including the Director of National Intelligence. And so, you know, a lot of that information now probably will be restricted in some ways. You know, instead of back and forths exchanged behind closed doors in meetings between lawmakers and the DNI, they'll have to write written responses back and forth. And as you know, those take time and can get really bogged down. So there's a time delay that, you know, and we don't know what's going to happen in the next 60 days, but, you know, time is often of the essence. And in this case, those delays could be significant.
Yeah. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. Thank you.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers the House of Representatives leadership. And we have been talking with him about some of this week's top national political stories, including some opposing messages related to Kenosha here in Wisconsin. If, when this global pandemic has subsided, you think, I'd like to travel to Botswana, and you go and you see cows, do not be alarmed by the fact that they may have eyes on their hindquarters. The eye spots are painted on these cows as a way to deter lions from attack. Farmers need the cattle for survival and let them roam because they can't afford fences, and that means cows are easy picking for lions. So to avoid farmers killing the lions before they can kill their cattle, researchers decided to paint eyes on their butts, so it looks like they're facing that direction. This makeup isn't exactly natural, but it does take cues from other species trying to avoid predators. Atlas Obscura reports that insects have eye spots to confuse birds. Fish have false sets of eyes to scare off bigger fish. And it seems to work on cattle. With more than 2,000 cows in a trial, a third got furrowed acrylic paint eyes on their behinds. Predators killed 19 cows, but not one had eyes on the back of its body. And because I know you're curious, yes, when you look at the pictures of cattle with eyes painted on their hips, it really is like those creepy paintings. The eyes seem to follow you whichever way you move. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for joining us here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.